Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hi, I'm Grant Wall, and welcome to the Planet Football Podcast, where I go in-depth with the most intriguing people in the world of soccer. In this episode, I'm joined by Clint Smith, a guest I've wanted to have on the show for a long time. Just a quick reminder, it's a huge help if you subscribe to, rate, and review the podcast. It helps people find us. Onward! Our guest today is Clint Smith. You might know Clint from any number of places. He's a regular on the podcast Pod Save the People. He's a contributor to The New Yorker, among other places. He's a Harvard doctoral candidate whose research interests include mass incarceration, the sociology of race and racism, and the history of U.S. inequality. A former National Poetry Slam champion, Clint wrote a book of poetry, Counting Dissent, that was a finalist for an NAACP Image Award. He's widely followed on Twitter at Clint Smith III, Clint Smith III. And for the purposes of this podcast, he's a former Division I soccer player at Davidson and a huge Arsenal fan who has written occasionally on soccer, including on the recent World Cup for The New Yorker. Clint, thanks for joining me.
Appreciate you having me.
That was a long introduction. You do a lot of different things. I'm really excited to have you on the show.
I appreciate it. Yeah, got my foot in a couple different places.
So I want to start saying you're from New Orleans and you're a relatively young guy. How did your soccer story begin?
Yeah, so I'm born and raised in New Orleans, and it's fascinating, actually. So I played soccer my entire life, kind of ended up by accident. So my mom, nobody in my family had really played soccer before, and my mom meant to sign me up for the football league and missed the registration deadline. And someone at her job was like, oh, well, you should just sign him up for soccer and he can, you know, sign up for football next year. And she was like, sign him up for soccer. Nobody in my family plays soccer. But then, you know, I was 5 or 6 years old and they needed something to keep me busy. And so they signed me up for the local soccer league and it was over from there. I mean, I played multiple sports my whole life. I played soccer, baseball, basketball, football for a second, and then, you know, one kickoff return where I got schmollocked just ended that for me. And but ran track and cross country and did all these different things, but I just fell in love with the game. I became obsessed, as I think so many of us do. And I bought a small, must have been maybe like 14-inch TV that I begged my parents to set up in my room, and I would watch Ajax training videos and do sort of try to do the Ajax Cruyff drills in my in my room, much to the chagrin of my father, who would often come in and have to tell me to be quiet because I was making too much noise. And it was fascinating, I think, also as a social phenomenon, because I went to public school in New Orleans my whole life, but people. Black people in the South did not play, or didn't, especially when I was growing up, I think it's beginning to change now, but didn't play soccer, especially at the club level and at the tribal club level in any sort of large fashion. So I was the only one of, I was often the only or one of the only people of color on my soccer team. And so it was fascinating sort of moving between these two spaces as a kid. Between, you know, a public school in New Orleans and a travel soccer team with kids largely from the suburbs in New Orleans, and sort of having to navigate those different social circles in ways that I can look back on now and sort of assign a sort of historical or sociological language to it, and some of the things that I was experiencing and the things that I was feeling and the sort of cognitive dissonance that I often experienced. But I didn't necessarily have the language to understand it at that point. And I played my whole life. I loved the game. I had a dream of going pro. I was like, I'm going to go play for Arsenal. I got a Thierry Henry jersey when I was 10 years old from my mom, who went to an event in London for work and then came back. And it's funny because she asked the cabs. My mom, again, didn't know much about soccer. And she asked the cabbie in North London. She was like, who's the soccer team for London? I want to get my son a jersey, which obviously is an innocent question and one that would make sense in a U.S. sports context. But the cabbie laughed and was like, there's only one team in London, man. And he told her to get an Arsenal jersey. And she did, and she brought it back. And I think she saw a photo in the shop of a guy who looked relatively like me, and that was Henri. And so she bought that and brought it back, and I obsessed over him and his career and thus Arsenal. I did not end up going pro, even though I should have anticipated that. But I ended up getting a soccer scholarship to Davidson College in North Carolina, and I ended up there in large part because Hurricane Katrina was my senior year of high school. Mm-hmm. And I ended up in Houston, Texas, and we were on my aunt and uncle's couch and watching CNN, you know, watching the neighborhood I grew up in under 8, 9, 10 feet of water. And I was getting recruited by a number of different schools, and Davidson was one of them, but I didn't know much about it. It wasn't at the top of my list, but the coach, Matt Spear, called me and he said, I know you're going through a lot right now, and we were wondering if we could move your official visit up. And you know, have you come here, maybe serve as a distraction from what you're experiencing. And I jumped at the opportunity. I mean, I think I was a 17-year-old kid just kind of trapped in this endless cycle of despair, watching the news and watching my hometown underwater. And I ended up going to Davidson that weekend, had an incredible time, fell in love with the school, with the team, and committed on the spot. And my college soccer experience was not as successful, so to speak, as I would have liked it to be. I accomplished the dream of being a Division I soccer player, but I actually didn't play a lot. And that was a fascinating thing for me to experience, because I think I grew up in Louisiana, which is not necessarily a hotbed of soccer talent, or hasn't always been historically. We've certainly had good folks come out of there. Most notably, I think Patrick Mullins, who mm-hmm. won the Herman Trophy twice, and who I grew up playing with. But you know, as compared to New York or California, we are not top tier necessarily. But I was all state, all metro, all city in high school, and then I started playing D1, and it was, you know, playing against UVA and UNC and Wake Forest and a lot of these ACC teams who were near us was sort of rude awakening into the sort of larger soccer ecosystem in the U.S. But I also, you know, at the end of the day, I got to play the game I love with some of my best friends, and I got a scholarship to do that. And it ended up being the best thing that could have happened, because it forced me to figure out who I was off the soccer field, which I hadn't really spent a lot of time doing, because my identity was so deeply interwoven into being like Clint, the soccer player. And that's when I found writing, and that's when I got a real passion for literature and history. And had I had a different type of soccer career that hadn't pushed me to figure out who I was off the field, then I imagine that my life would probably look a lot different now.
It's a fascinating story. And I'm struck by sort of the happenstance about how you got connected to the sport. You know, recently on the podcast, we had on Eddie Johnson, mm-hmm. who retired a couple of years ago, but had a good career. And, you know, he's from Bunnell, Florida. And the only reason he even got connected to soccer was because he saw a guy driving down the street one day when he was a kid advertising this soccer league. And he had no idea what it was, got into it. I mean, you mentioned how you've written this too, that you're often the only black player on the field. Why don't we see more black soccer players in the United States? And in your opinion, what can be done about it?
Yeah, well, I think hope, it seems like that's changing a bit. I mean, I think that if you look at the sort of the current crop of young guys who are coming up on the U.S. national team, I mean, I saw a team photo from the most recent camp, and I kind of sat back in my chair for a second because I was like, I could have never imagined this when I was a kid. I mean, you got, you know, so many, 18, 19-year-old, 20-year-old kids who are playing, you know, in Germany and in France and in England and here, you know, here in the MLS and doing incredible work and who are largely going to become the center of this crop of guys coming up. And I think of how, you know, when I was a kid and I looked at the U.S. national team, there was Kobe Jones, there was Eddie Pope, and you know, a few, and Ernie Stewart and others, but it wasn't, it felt like, you know, few and far between. And there, you know, if you were a black soccer player looking for an American soccer role model, there weren't many people to choose from. And I'm so excited for, you know, young kids growing up now who get to look at the national team and what the national team is becoming and see such a plurality of backgrounds represented. And it's just a really, really exciting thing. And I think part of the reason that that's happening is because folks are recognizing that it's necessary to create opportunities for folks who might not have the resources, folks who might not have traditionally been engaged in the sport or had the sport as part of the sort of ecosystem or landscape of their communities, to provide access for them to participate at the highest level. And, you know, I think the biggest culprit for why more black folks, you know, especially when I was growing up, and I think to some extent still now, don't play is because of pay to play. And it's an expensive game when you know, playing club soccer. And I think we didn't have the sort of academy system that is beginning to develop now when I was playing growing up. And I think that the way that the cost structure that different clubs have and the ways in which they offer sort of scholarship or reduced prices and fees for certain folks, depending on the income of their parents, is really helpful. And I think that's super helpful for getting more Latino folks engaged in the system, and not in an informal way, as has been the case for a long time, but sort of in a more formally structured way, I think, you know, and more people of color generally. And that's not to say clearly that all people of color are living in low socioeconomic conditions, but obviously given the history of this country, the very real correlation between socioeconomic status and race is one that we have to be cognizant of and consider. And I think that's a huge reason. But it's fascinating. You know, I think there are also geographical differences, because I grew up in Louisiana, which is a very specific social and geographic context. And I remember when I came to play at Davidson, one of my closest friends on the team was in Maryland. I played in Maryland. And I saw a photo of his youth team, and it was staggering how many black people were on his team. I was just like, is this how it always was for you? And he's like, yeah, there are always this many black, I mean, and like, you know, people from the Caribbean, people from, you know, who are first generation West African immigrants, people who have been in, you know, whose parents have been in the country for generations. It was such a, it represented such a remarkable plurality of the black experience in this one soccer team, in a way that I had never seen before. So I think there's also something to be said for the way it looks different in different parts of the country. And I can't speak to every part of the country, but I do know that if we make adjustments to pay to play, and if we just like provide more access in terms of, you know, putting places for people to play informally. I know Atlanta has tried to do this to varying degrees of success and other places throughout the U.S. But I really think that's it, right? Like, where can you just go put a ball down and play? And that's not going to like lock the fence, or that's not going to make you schedule a time to play. And, you know, in here in the D.C. area, there's been so much contention around how gentrification has impacted so many of the playing areas in the area. And I think, you know, there are places where, immigrants and people of color have been playing informally and been playing pickup for decades that are now used for, you know, more formal recreational, you know, district leagues and like company and corporate leagues that, and you have to reserve the time of, you know, certain times on the field and things that, that run counter to how the culture of that space used to be. And so I think that these are real, questions that, that different cities and neighborhoods have to resolve. But I think, again, if you fix pay to play and if you, make the game more accessible, in these communities, then I think you'll see, you'll continue to see a big difference.
A year and a half ago, you wrote a story for The New Yorker called Freddie Adu and the Children of the Beautiful Game. In that story, you recalled watching Adu during his first season in MLS and wanting him to become the first true U.S. global soccer superstar who was black. Actually, it would be the first U.S. global soccer superstar, period, on the men's side. Maybe I hadn't thought about things in those terms as much, because Adu came from another country to live in the U.S., perhaps. I'm not totally sure why I hadn't thought of it as much. But if Adu had made it, do you think he would have especially resonated with the black community in the U.S. and helped create fans who weren't soccer fans before?
I think he could have. I think, you know, I remember in that piece, I was having conversations with a bunch of my friends from high school, and I remember, I just remember so clearly how there was, even as popular as Eddie Pope was, popular as even Kobe Jones was during his heyday, like they weren't mainstays in the sort of cultural and sporting discourse for people who were not familiar with soccer in the same way that Freddie Adu did when he burst onto the scene, right? I mean, the entire story around Freddie was just like 14 years old. He came and he scored, like within the first couple of weeks, he scored that amazing goal against the LA Galaxy, which was like, you know, Sports Center top 10. You know, it was there are highlights everywhere. And this, and you, people were just like, this is a 14-year-old phenom, number one pick in the draft. There was so much buzz about him that he became, I mean, I think about the Jeremy Lin moment, right? And I think about, how special and how important that was for so many of my Asian American friends, who had never seen anyone who looked like them become the face of a sport, even if it was for a short amount of time. And I think, you know, obviously they're not exactly parallel, but I think about the Freddie moment and how, you know, when I was often the only of my black friends, the only person who played soccer. And so, you know, my friends would come to my high school game and like, they don't know anything about the game, but like, as soon as I got the ball, they'd be like, go get him, Freddie is due out here. Blah, 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 blah. Right. Because that was their sort of reference point. That was their framework. And there was something, I think of what, you know, I think of what could have been. And obviously, you know, there were so many different difficulties and so much pressure that was put on him that I think made, success difficult from the get go. And the expectations, I can't even begin to fathom as a 14-year-old, how you even begin to navigate that. But I do think there was a real moment in which he captured, in the same way that like the Williams sisters continue to capture the excitement of a community of folks who likely otherwise wouldn't be very engaged in tennis. The same way that, you know, Tiger Woods comes back and not even just in the black community, in the entire, you know, sporting community, in the industry of folks who watch golf, how exciting that is. Because I think there's something about having someone who is not traditionally represented as the face of a sport succeeding in that sport, and the sort of the pride that it creates for folks, and the excitement and the ways that it creates a different sort of investment. Because again, you know, the history of this country is one in which, you know, we have been very, black folks have been very purposefully excluded or prevented from participating, in, you know, in so many different parts of the American project, and soccer is one of those, right? In ways that are sometimes subtle and in ways that are sometimes more explicit. But I think that, you know, it is not an accident that soccer has been sort of made into the caricature of soccer in the United States is one that is, you know, orange slices and, you know, and the suburbs. I think it has been presented and maybe for some people, not all people, but for some people, wanted to be kept as this thing that was apart from the other parts of the sporting industry that were, you know, dominated largely by people of color.
Before I ask you another question about Arsenal, we need to clear something up here for anyone who follows you on Twitter. Your avatar has you in a Juventus jersey, not an Arsenal jersey.
I know.
What's the reasoning here?
Oh, man. I know. It's funny because people, I think all the soccer folks who follow me are like very confused. They're like, why are you wearing a Juventus jersey if you're an Arsenal fan? And everybody else who follows me is like, I thought that you were a priest. Or I thought that you were wearing a suit. Or I thought—I mean, I'm struck by how many people, because of the black and white stripes, thought it was something other than what it was. But yeah, I mean, it was. You put it up about a year ago. It was just—I thought it was a good picture. And I wear soccer jerseys all the time. I mean, I travel a lot for work, and soccer jerseys, as we all know, is just like these like really amazing, often wrinkle-free shirts that then you just throw into a suitcase and toss it out, and they're great to travel in. They're great to wear. They're it's kind of my just like default setting is sweatpants and soccer jerseys. And so I don't have any particular allegiance to Juventus. I have about 25 jerseys that I wear on different occasions, but Arsenal has my heart and forever will.
I will have listeners know that you're wearing an AC Milan jersey right now.
I know it's confusing. I'm terrible.
So you wrote a story for the New Yorker called "The Agony of Being an Arsenal Fan," and I'm wondering, on the agony scale of things right now, how are you feeling these days about Arsenal?
I got to tell you, I am optimistic. I am perpetually known as I'm on a group chat with a bunch of my college friends from our soccer days. And at every point, you know, Arsenal, there is at every point for the past decade or so, Arsenal have had a consistent run of wins, an extended unbeaten streak that moves us into maybe like second or third place. And I'm the person that's always like, this is it. This is the moment we turn things around. The title is coming. Here we go. And like everybody has to be like, Clint, this literally happens every single year. But I think that Liverpool game that just happened was really revealing in the sort of character of the team in a way that I hadn't seen before. I think that's the game that in the past we would have lost. I think it's a game that we would have our shoulders would have fallen and we wouldn't have been able to come back. And I got to tell you, like, Lacazette has just been in astounding form. I was very skeptical and confused as to why Emery was so reticent to play he and Aubameyang together at the beginning of the season. But I think those two on their best days, not always, but on their best days work really well in tandem. And I think it really also speaks to the strength of the French squad that Lacazette like can't get into that team because. He really, I mean, he's one of the top strikers in the Premier League, if not all of Europe. And he's, you know, he's just so potent. And I think the rest of the team is really finding their identity. And there's just a different spirit. There's a different spirit. And you know, I became an Arsenal fan when Wenger was in charge. And I have nothing but respect for him. And I think that what he did and his tenure is unprecedented, you know, other than Alex Ferguson. And I think there is something so special about his association with that club and with the team and what they, I'll always remember that 2003 season with the Invincibles and how we went undefeated. And it was, you know, even now it is, it just brings a smile to my face to think about it. But, you know, we are, it's a new day. And I think that we needed something fresh and we needed something new. And that's not to discredit Wenger for everything that he did for the club, which is an innumerable amount. But it is to say that, but I think we have someone who brings the best out of our players, and that's exciting to see.
Well, I hope your optimism on Arsenal is rewarded. We'll have to wait and see. It's a long season ahead. You mentioned that you're still in touch with guys from Davidson, which is a pretty small school. I'm pretty sure that Steph Curry was there when you were there. Did you have any interactions with him?
Yeah, we were in the same class. So Steph is a good friend, and it's been pretty extraordinary to see the rise of his career. I mean, I think, you know, when we all showed up freshman year, we were just, you know, no one could have expected him to become who he was. Maybe he did, but, you know, he grew, I think, probably 4 inches when we were in school, 4 or 5 inches. He and just, you know, he was always, we always knew that he was a really, really incredible shooter. And that, like, if, you know, if he ran a screen and got him open, then he would knock down those threes all day. But the way he's developed, like the fullness of his game and the way that he's developed as a player is really extraordinary. And above all, he's like a very genuinely good person. And I know that that can't be said for everybody in professional sports, but for Steph is like really a good guy, a family man, super thoughtful, I think it's thoughtful and judicious about like how he uses his platform in ways that I think we're beginning to see increasingly. I think for a good reason across a lot of guys in particularly the NBA, but not just the NBA. I mean, you know, even in the NFL and people who are like recognizing the way that they can use their platform in a justice-oriented way. And I think Steph, you know, in some ways more subtle and discreet than others, has continued to use his platform in a way that that is centering, you know, empathy, in a way that is centering projects oriented toward justice. And he's got an adorable family. And so, you know, I'm super proud of him. We whenever we're in the same city, we try to connect. And whenever he comes to D.C., I try to go to his games, or if I'm in the Bay. We were a school of 1,600 kids when we were there, and so we all knew each other very well.
Nice. You live in Washington D.C. Does D.C. United or the women's team there them interest you?
So yeah, I've lived in D.C. I lived here from 2011 to 2014, where I was a high school English teacher, and then I went to graduate school, and then I moved back about a year and a half ago. We moved back, my wife and I, when we had our first child. And the thing about having a toddler is that it's wonderful. You're all so tired all the time. And so I am, a lot of the last, you know, 17 months has been chasing him around and trying to write my dissertation. So I haven't actually gotten to a game yet, which I feel terrible about. I was supposed to go to the playoff game, which was such a heartbreaker. But you know, what Rooney did for DC United was really extraordinary, and I'm excited for next season. I'm telling myself that, like, now that we're settled, I'm going to try and get some season tickets and vote to them and to the women's team, because, you know, I think the game, the American game is growing, and I remember I used to turn on an MLS game and then flip back and forth between an MLS game and a Premier League game, and it looked like, you know, people playing soccer underwater as compared to what you were seeing in England. But I think that gap is narrowing. I think that, you know, we have the game, the speed of the game is growing, and the quality of the players is exponentially higher than I think it was across the board before. And things are getting more competitive, right? I mean, like, Toronto won the championship last season, didn't even make the playoffs this season. So yeah. I think that there's a parity that's developing, that's really good for the game, and I'm excited to see it and to the extent that I can as a fan be a part of it.
I figure I should say this, we're recording this the day before the midterm election day, which is obviously a huge thing, but we're coming out after election day. How often does your soccer world overlap with your other worlds that you're in?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I have played in a Sunday league here, and not as consistently as I would like, again, just because, you know, 17-month-olds are unpredictable, and Sundays often end up being something different, and then I also travel a lot. But, you know, soccer for me is you can't sort of disentangle politics from any facet of one's life, I don't think. You know, I think about how so much of what I learned about the world and the politics of the world growing up were because I watched soccer and how I, because I watched soccer, particularly in Europe. And I thought about what it meant to have all of those people from different nations on the same team. And I thought about the sort of the project, the post-World War II project of like a pluralistic liberal democracy across borders, which is like a really sort of unique thing in sort of global history. And I think about how fragile that is, right? And I think about, you know, even if you look at the World Cup and you look at, you know, the World Cup started, has only, you know, only started as an entity in the early part of the 20th century. I think mm-hmm. was the first World Cup was in 1932 in Uruguay, something like that.
Yeah, like 1930.
And so like this is still, I mean, the very idea that you would be able to have all nations come together in order to participate in a collective global endeavor is like really a new thing in over the course of human civilization. And I think that sometimes we lose that and we forget that, and we forget how fragile that is and how it can become, how it doesn't take much to for that to unravel and to begin to look very different. And I think that we have been living in frightening times, to be honest. And I think that, you know, the spread of authoritarianism across the world has made people more cognizant of the fact that this is not the state of the world as we understand it, and the role of the United States within it is not an inevitability. And I think that soccer is this sort of fascinating microcosm with which to or through which to sort of engage in an analysis of what the sort of global order looks like. And the sort of interplay. I mean, there's so much to be said about the interplay of race and capitalism and globalization in the way that, you know, in how FIFA operates, in the way that, you know, certain and what the teams in certain places look like. I mean, I think in the way that certain players, I think about for maybe it was 5 or 10 years ago, and not to say it doesn't happen now, but like all of the black players in the Eastern European countries or even in Italy who talk about having bananas thrown at them or mm-hmm. having monkey noises made. And, you know, part of what my own research and scholarship is around is sort of manifestations, the different manifestations and iterations of white supremacy and anti-blackness, specifically in the United States, but also across the world, and what that means and what that looks like. And, you know, in Brazil, there was just like an authoritarian president who was just elected, who said horrible things about the people from the African diaspora and indigenous Brazilians. And what does that mean for, you know, if you look at the Brazilian national team or even the players who, you know, become successful in the Brazilian league, what does that mean for that? You know, so I think there's always something to be said about the relationship between sports and the sort of broader political world in which we're living, and I don't think that they can be stripped away from one another at all.
You wrote about the World Cup for The New Yorker. At one point, you had written that it was a bummer that the U.S. failed to qualify for that World Cup for a number of reasons, including which, at this time in the world's history, it would have been good for the U.S. to be part of a truly global gathering. What was your favorite story from the World Cup this year?
Man, I think that the story of just the stoppage time, goals, and the VAR. I mean, I think VAR completely changed the dynamics of the World Cup in ways that I think are positive. I think I'm a pro VAR person, except when. Except I wasn't this weekend because Arsenal would have lost if there was VAR in the Premier League. But other than that, I'm pro VAR because I think it actually protects the integrity of the game. And I don't think it slows it down as much as people thought. And I think that it forces folks to play with more integrity. And I think it pushes folks to know that there's, you know, even the slight, I think there's something to be said for the sort of flexibility of the game and of the sport and letting it flow and go as it will, and how certain, you know, certain things that transpire, not everything will be will be caught by a referee, but I do think that if something should be a penalty or if something was offsides or if something would have been a goal but otherwise wouldn't, I think it's not good for the game if we have the technology to know if you know this play resulted in a goal or if this play resulted in offsides, to then not use that technology to bring that integrity to the sport. I think it's a good thing. So, but it also changed the game in huge ways. I think there were so many more penalties, and then stoppage time was just like, I mean, you truly couldn't leave your seat on the couch at any point because I think every other game there was a stoppage time goal or two. It was by far the most exciting World Cup that I've ever watched. And I think this, you know, the storylines, there's a sort of political storylines of what it meant for it to be in Russia and Russia to make the quarterfinals and Putin, even though, you know, Putin very clearly, is this sort of bad actor on the world stage. And, but also, you know, I mean, the sort of dissonance of it all, but also I think it was important because it reminded the world, and I think reminded me, that Russia is so much more than Putin, right? Mm-hmm. That there were like people, there were people in the street. And I think it's a reminder that we have to the extent that we can, decouple governments from citizens. And that's not right. to say there aren't connections, but I think, you know, in the same way that we wouldn't want anyone to look at Trump as singularly representative of the American people, although unfortunately he is representative of some many Americans, too many, but I think in the same way that we, you know, I think when we think of Russia, we automatically begin to think of Putin rather than the, like, millions of human beings who are so interesting and have their own stories and their own histories and their own complex three-dimensionalities, that we sometimes forget. And I think, you know, seeing how much it meant for everyday Russians to have the world come to Russia for those few weeks was I think a really important reminder for me not to make Russia sort of caricature of itself, despite what Putin does and how much I love the Americans.
Yeah.
The show.
Yeah, that was one of my big takeaways too after spending 40 days in Russia was, sure, it certainly didn't change my opinion about Putin, but I was exposed to a lot of ordinary Russians who got a lot of joy out of that Russian World Cup run. As we wrap up here, I'm curious to know if you think there are any soccer stories out there these days that are undercovered, things that we should be talking about more, that we should be writing about more. What's your sense?
Good question. That's a really good question. I think for me, and it's not to say that we're undercovering, and this is related to your question, but I think it's just something that I'm trying to be more thoughtful about myself, is the way that we discuss the game and how sometimes we unconsciously or inadvertently kind of erase the women's game and you know, in the U.S. or abroad. And I think that over the course of the World Cup, even just the language we use, right? I have made the mistake of talking about the U.S. national team that, you know, is XYZ or is, and I've had people correct me and be like, make sure, you know, it's an important distinction, like the U.S. because I would say like, oh, the U.S. national team is so disappointing and you know, U.S. soccer is so terrible. These are moments in extreme frustration after we failed to qualify for the World Cup. And I think it's important to remember that actually, like, the women's national team has been the most successful team in the history of the world for soccer. And I think that, you know, just continuing to remember, think about like who we are including and who we are not including in mm-hmm. our narrative around the game. I think our default can become talking about the men's game. And I think that for me, I'm always trying to be careful and thoughtful about making sure that, you know, we are not excluding an entire demographic of athletes from our conversations when we talk about how to move forward, you know, as a country with this game or what the different dynamics of the game look like around the world. And I think that's really important. So that's not to say that it's undercovered necessarily, but I think it's often failed to be discussed as thoroughly as it often deserves to be.
Yeah, it's something to keep in mind all the time, but also we're in a Women's World Cup year, just a few months to go before that Women's World Cup, which the U.S. will actually be playing in. Lastly, I just wanted to ask you, who do you think is the most intriguing soccer player in the world right now?
The most intriguing in the world? I got to tell you, I mean, I think I'm fascinated by Mbappe. I mean, I think just to be 19 years old, and when I was 19, I was like eating, you know, cheese quesadillas at 2 a.m. in the union, and you know, trying to finish my like theology exam before it was due 3 hours later. I mean, to be 19 years old and to have already won, to have been arguably the best player, or one of the best players in the World Cup, as a teenager, and to have the poise with which he plays, and to play alongside at PSG, you know, are one of the top three players in the world, and to often outshine that player. I think that his career is going to be really fascinating to watch, because so much of the narrative that surrounds, you know, our greatest players, whether it be Ronaldo or Messi or Neymar, is tied to whether or not they can like garner the ultimate success in the form of winning a World Cup. And I'm so curious what it looks like for us, how he thinks of and how we think of as a sort of, you know, fan and media apparatus to think about what success looks like for a kid who has already accomplished the greatest feat in his sport. And whether that serves as a means of sort of relief and this thing that doesn't have to sit on his shoulders for the entirety of his career, or if it sort of, you know, conversely becomes something that, you know, if he's winning the league every year for PSG and he already won the World Cup, what is it that he's striving for, or reaching for? I'm always curious about like motivation in players. And, you know, I would say the Champions League, but now there's this sort of conversation about a European Super League, which I think is a terrible and ridiculous. when I think of the perils of capitalism and how it like tries to ruin everything that is good, I'm like, it would just ruin the integrity of European soccer, and I hope it doesn't come to manifest. But I think Mbappe is super fascinating. And then in the U.S., I think Timothy Weah is really interesting, because, you know, because his own history and his father, the president of Liberia, and, you know, his story and the sort of like pizzazz with which he plays. And, you know, he's like, I think that he's such an interesting person and an interesting young man. And I think, you know, is part of a crop of players who are doing some really interesting stuff in for U.S. soccer, for U.S. men's soccer.
Yeah, I interviewed Weah for the first time last month after he had a really tremendous assist on Bobby Wood's goal against Colombia. Really interesting guy. Clint Smith is on Twitter at Clint Smith III, Clint Smith III. You can read his stuff on a lot of different topics, and you should, but if you want to read his soccer stuff, just Google Clint Smith soccer, and lots of stuff will show up. Thank you so much for joining the podcast.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Planet Football Podcast. I'd like to thank Clint Smith, as well as everyone at Cadence 13 and Sports Illustrated who supports this podcast. Just a quick reminder, it's a huge help if you subscribe to, rate, and review the podcast. It helps people find us. And check out the 30-minute Planet Football video show hosted by me and Luis Miguel Echegaray on SITV. That's available on SI.TV, Amazon Channels, and Fubo TV. See you next time.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.